Welcome to the Think Christian podcast, where there's no such thing as secular. Now, before we begin, only those who've been born again are welcome to this episode. Just kidding. Come on in. I'm Josh Larson, your host and editor at thinkchristian.net. I've always been a bit unsure about that phrase, born again. I guess maybe it's because I was raised in a Christian home, so I never really had a dramatic born again moment to speak of. And maybe I've sometimes wondered, am I really in if that hasn't happened? On today's show, we're asking, what did Jesus mean when he told Nicodemus that no one can see the kingdom of God unless they are born again? We're going to consider that encounter from John's Gospel in light of Schitt's Creek, which just wrapped up its final season, and Sufjan Stevens' new album, The Ascension. One features characters who experience a certain kind of transformation. The other, well, this is Sufjan Stevens, so it's complicated. J.R. Forresteros is here to talk Schitt's Creek. And before either of us get into trouble, J.R., can you do me this favor? Maybe spell out the title of the show, and maybe you can explain a little bit the premise of this Canadian sitcom.
Yeah, obviously the name is part of the joke, right? So it's S-C-H-I-T-T.
Yes.
And that is a family name of the family that sort of runs this little town. But the premise is a wealthy family falls on hard times. They basically had I think he was their family's business accountant, like of the family business, which is a series of video stores, who embezzled all of their money. And so through no fault of their own, technically, they lost everything except for this town that the dad had purchased for the son sort of as a joke at one point ages ago and then forgot about. And so this is the only asset they have left. So this incredibly wealthy, privileged family is forced to move to this small town, like vaguely Midwestern small town.
Yeah, I could never quite tell if it's because it's a Canadian sitcom, but it seems to be set somewhere in the U.S.
That was my feeling as well. But again, they're sort of intentionally vague about
right.
It, but it's the riches to rags story, right? And then how does this family adapt to being in this town? And how does the town adapt to this ridiculous, outrageous family that has no clue at all how to be normal?
Yeah, yeah. To how to even interact with someone that you get the sense they're not paying for some sort of service, right?
Yes, that is a great way to put it, yes.
And there's comedy royalty at work here because we have Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara as Johnny Rose and Moira Rose, the parents. So, you know, from Best in Show, Mighty Wind, all of those improvisational comedy classics, they're working together again here. They're so great. And Eugene Levy's son, Dan Levy, plays David Rose, their son. He actually created the series with his dad, with Eugene. And then Annie Murphy plays Alexis, who is the daughter and David's sister. And it's a great cast. I mean, they're so good together, how they interact, all four of them, not just, you'd expect that from Levy and O'Hara, having done it so much over the years. But really, this family unit is hilarious. And the final season, it's been available in Canada for a while, but just came to Netflix in the U.S. last month. Really has been quarantine comfort food for me and my family.
Yes.
My family was in on this before I was. They started watching it, you know, off on their own, and then I would jump in here or there. But we all got together for this final season. I even wrote about it myself for the TC website. But I want to hear first what you think of the show, JR, especially now that it's all over.
You know, it was a show that I actively avoided because of the title. You know, I was like, oh, this just looks like something dumb, you know. And then we kept hearing all of the buzz about it. So my wife and I finally sat down to watch it. And I was sure that she would hate it because she doesn't like Arrested Development. She doesn't like The Office, like any of these shows where a lot of the humor comes out of these awkward exchanges.
Sure.
And yet she actually fell for Schitt's Creek before I did.
Okay.
You know, I was enjoying it, but not loving it at first. And then, you know, by the end of the first season, I was solidly on board. But I kept asking her, why does this show work for you when so many of these other shows that I enjoy so much don't? And she finally came around to the kindness that's at the heart of the show.
Okay.
She said, you know, in Arrested Development, you are meant to laugh at these people.
Yep.
Everyone is mean to everyone, and that's kind of the heart of the show. Even The Office largely is that. I mean, it's, yes, I think at the end of the day, Dwight and Jim might consider themselves friends, maybe by the time you get to season 7 or something like that. But it is a deep antagonism for so much of the show. And same thing with Michael, you know, all of those. Whereas, again, in Schitt's Creek, there is just this warm heart at the center of it where you get the sense that this family is genuinely realizing that they love each other and how the town also embraces them, and in some funny, obviously, and sometimes awkward, but strangely warm and believable ways, they come to be this large extended family. And we both just love that while we were also laughing uproariously at every single episode.
I think that's right. And I think the Office comparison is good because I think of, you know, the Office and Parks and Rec on different ends of the spectrum, sort of, where the Office definitely moves that way, but you don't always believe it in those final seasons. Whereas Parks and Rec had that affection for its characters, no matter how ridiculous they were, right from the start. And I think you're right that you see that in Schitt's Creek too, even as we're obviously meant to laugh both at the Roses, but also really at the residents of the town for being hillbilly-ish and, you know, the complete opposite of the Roses. And it's almost like this coming together as the seasons progress and they all get to know each other a little bit more. And the transformation that takes place, mostly I'd say on the Roses part. But that's interesting that you and your wife identified, you know, that sort of warmth among them, even at the beginning, because it kind of does relate to what I wrote about. And this is the show as being an expression of rebirth, you know, of being born again. I like that idea that it's not a complete transition into something you weren't at all before, but it's rather kind of finding the best of you that was there at the beginning and reorienting yourself towards that. And I think you kind of see something like that as the series progresses. The family's transformation in particular, I'd say, from being these inward-focused elitists to, I guess, humbled community members in some way. But I do think you have to see this biblical idea of being born again as not necessarily a one-time event that perfects you, but maybe something that's more a continual process that can be traced over a lifetime even, or in this case, over a TV series. So for me, Schitt's Creek, when I think back on the whole thing, what I really see is a collection of messy born-again moments. And I just want to highlight a couple of those here that were my favorites when I think about the whole series run. I think the middle couple of seasons were really important for the transition. And so season three, there's this moment where Johnny, the father, is caught plagiarizing and writing Alexis's paper, right? This economics paper she has to write. She doesn't realize he's doing this. And then when she finds out, she asks him, well, why didn't you do this when I was younger? She's not appalled that he's cheating, right? She wanted him to cheat when she was younger. And he says, because I wasn't around back then to help you cheat. And I regret it. And what's perfect is that, like, he's changed, but he's not perfect, right? It's not that he's apologetic about cheating. It's that he wasn't a good enough father to be there for her.
And this is his way of being there now, right? Is he's going to do this paper for her.
Exactly. He's been born again enough to be present, but also to cheat. So there's so many moments like that. I think of Alexis in this final season when she starts to give the spotlight to Stevie, the manager of the hotel, who they come to know really well. And she gives Stevie some role in David's wedding plans, even though that's really hard for Alexis. David even says, I think she asked David, what's happening to me? And David says, you're going soft. So again, it's kind of like, it's only a partial recognition of the change. You know, it's not that she's completely for the better or even that they're comfortable with who they're becoming, but it recognizes something is happening. And David himself, you know, Dan Levy, his entire performance is all about his face for me, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And you can picture, like, it begins, he has this open mouth look of appalled disbelief at his situation, at these people they're living among. But that changes as the series goes on. Again, not to an open-hearted smile, but kind of these pursed lips that are leaning toward a smile, leaning toward genuine appreciation of them. But he doesn't want to give them that satisfaction, even in those final episodes, right? There's still some of the old him there, I think.
I think with David, one of the biggest moments that I think embodies this sort of rebirth you're talking about is the little dance number that he does for his fiance.
Oh,
because,
yeah.
Again, David is so, like, his character is all about the facade, right? The being better, being taken seriously. You know, his little boutique store in this small town is, like, absurdly pretentious for where it is, you know.
For that market, yep.
Right. That's one of the first moments where we see him truly humble himself and get out of his own way and be authentically silly And it's all motivated by love for his partner. And it's something that season one David would not ever have dreamed of doing.
Right, right. There's a vulnerability there that he's actually showing, which you don't see a lot of. Yeah, so I'm curious just to hear from you, you know, if you think, you're the pastor here, do you think I'm selling, I know you love it when I pull that card out, but am I selling this biblical idea of being born again short by looking at it as more of a process than a single event?
Not at all. I don't think so at all. In fact, in my theological tradition, with the Wesleyan holiness tradition, we put as much emphasis on sanctification as we do on justification. Justification is that theological moment when we're made right with God. But sanctification is this becoming like God, right? Mm. And you have some theologians who will say that it is also a singular event like the salvation moment. But I think most of us tend to look at sanctification as this ongoing process. So where Paul says, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Some of my favorite theologians will say, we have been saved, we are being saved, we will be saved, mm-hmm. right? And so looking at that sort of like, yes, there was a moment where we came to Christ. Yes, there is a future moment when we will be glorified. But in between that is this beautiful process. I love the way you said it in the article and earlier in this conversation, this process of coming to know the truest version of who we are, right? That imago Dei that God created in us, and that salvation is really coming to know that person that Christ reveals in us, right? That true self that is made whole when we come to Christ. And I think especially in this day and age, it is incredibly healthy for Christians to understand the ongoing process of discipleship as one of being born again and again and again. The example that you have of Johnny Rose is so perfect, right? Where, yeah, we're better than we were yesterday, but we've still got some ways to go.
Right.
And I think too often we look backwards and pat ourselves on the back, and too often we don't say, what's next for us? How is God continuing to reveal places that need to be born again and again and again and again?
Sure, sure. Now, the one person we haven't talked about in any of these examples is Moira, Catherine O'Hara's Moira. So I'm curious, you know, it seems like she maybe progresses the least of all the characters. I don't know if that seems right to you, but I also wonder if maybe that's why she strikes me as the funniest character, because you need, comedy needs tension, right? And this is maybe goes back to The Office, why The Office kind of petered out, because once all that tension dissipated in Friendliness, it just wasn't as funny anymore. But Moira seems to be sticking to her elitist guns to the end. Does that seem fair?
You know, yeah, I would say definitely more so than the rest of them, right? In some ways, and it never, I think, again, the reason Moira works as a character is because it never feels cruel on her part.
That's true.
It feels clueless more than anything. And then again, I think you also get the hints of this woman that deeply, more than anything else, needs to be loved and affirmed, right? And that's why she's seeking out these roles. That's why she shanghais the community play from Jocelyn. But then again, you have those moments with Stevie where she really brings Stevie out of herself in a way that truly only Moira could. So she probably has moved the least by the end of the show, but there are still these clear moments of grace where Moira is learning to become something different. And I think in a way as well, the town learns to love her as she is.
Yeah.
Rather than as they wish that she were.
Yeah. No, that's really interesting you say that, because as I think back, this isn't necessarily a case of the townspeople forcing change upon the Roses. Like, they are so incredibly patient with them. And part of that is because they find them genuinely amusing. They could be insulted by them, and sometimes they are, but often they look at them and can't believe how clueless and insensitive these people are being without, especially Moira, without realizing it. And they're kind of bemused by it. And with that comes this patience that creates the space and offers the grace that you're talking about for them to make the movements that they do. So that's kind of a different sort of trajectory that you can trace throughout the series.
Yeah. And, you know, I think about, I'm blanking on David's partner's name at the moment, his character and Stevie, probably my favorite relationship in the film is how the two of them are thoroughly unimpressed by David.
At the beginning, especially, right?
Yeah, but you know, all of the things that David does to make himself look superior to not just the townspeople of Schitt's Creek, but his own family, to literally everyone he can think of, they see thoroughly through his facade, and then they love the person that they see.
Right.
And so all of their joking, all of their taking him down a peg or seven, it all is this like loving invitation to be his true authentic self. In a way, it's very much their love for him that enables him to grow.
Definitely.
And I think that's what you're talking about with the whole town, right? Like they all have all of these ambitions. I mean, Johnny is objectively a very good business person, mm-hmm. right? He grew a video empire. And when you see him doing things in Schitt's Creek, like they're things that work. And yet he also has to find his place in the town. And Roland and the guy that runs the auto garage that like rents him a desk,
you right, know, right.
like all of them give him the space to do that.
Yeah.
And again, I just kept thinking over and over as my wife and I would talk about the show or as I was getting ready to talk to you today, all the scripture that talks about God's kindness is the thing that leads us to repentance, you know, and looking again at the fact that, yeah, you have this terrible family that is blinded to the things that truly make them valuable. They've put so much stock in everything else. And yet it's this community that embraces them with kindness. That's not superficial niceness. Like they're not always nice to the roses, as you said, right? Like they're right, often like right. they are offended and they will call it out and they will tease them and all of that. It's this warmth and kindness that says, we choose to give you the space to become who you really are. And I think that's what we see over the six seasons of the show in some really powerful and surprising ways.
Patrick,
thank you. Oh, gosh.
The name of yes. David's partner, who you're thinking of. Yeah, played by Noah Reed. And we should also probably mention Stevie, because we brought her up, played by Emily Hampshire. And then Chris Elliott plays the yes. mayor, Roland. So I've been a longtime Chris Elliott fan. So that's been fun for me while watching this as well. Anything else you wanted to cover before we say goodbye to Schitt's Creek, JR?
I would just like to reiterate what you said. This is one of those shows where it actually reminds me a lot of Ted Lasso, which we also just finished, where it's not slight, but it is warm and it is enduring and there's genuine conflict, but the conflict comes out of characters who at the end of the day have a genuine love and regard for each other. And so, yeah, it is quarantine comfort programming to the nth degree. Yeah, if you haven't seen it yet, oh, it's just a delight.
I agree. And Ted Lasso, you're working on something for us, for the TC website on that, right?
That's correct, yep.
All right, we'll look forward to that. Thanks so much, JR, for joining me.
Always a pleasure, Josh. Thank you.
Reborn, rebirth, haunting, resurrection. It's fascinating how poets and artists have explored the idea of being born again. That was a little bit of Jack White's Over and Over and Over, a look at the Sisyphean dark side of rebirth from his Boarding House Reach album. Imagine if being born again meant having to push a boulder up a massive hill every single day. And did you know that Sisyphus was the king of Epirus, which was the same place we know as Corinth? Interesting. Even way outside the realm of the New Testament biblical idea, it seems that there is a deep hunger in our bones, maybe even a baked-in instinct that we are all destined to be born more than once, for better or for worse. Hello, I'm John J. Thompson, and this time I am honored to be serving as your musical midwife, culling together a batch of wildly diverse songs from rock and metal to pop, hip-hop, alternative soul, and Americana, all exploring the idea of rebirth. There are some upbeat and optimistic songs that look forward to rebirth, like the tunes from Kelly Clarkson, Tom Petty, Sia, Kings X, and even Black Sabbath. And there are some, like the tunes from Nine Inch Nails, Alice in Chains, Kendrick Lamar, Sufjan Stevens, and others, that take a bit of a more sideways view. I even threw a few in there, like one of the biggest hits of the 70s by Billy Preston, and one of my favorite early 90s hip-hop tracks by Digable Planets, which you will hear a bit of later here in the show, that take the concept of rebirth into very earthy places. To listen along, just search for the Think Christian profile on Spotify and hit play. As usual, this episode's batch will be called the latest episode for a while and listed as its own mix separately thereafter. And you can hear all of the mixes I've curated for the podcast there, either individually or gathered together in the archive list. And if you click the little button that looks like a recycle symbol to the right of the play button, the playlist will repeat over and over and over, being reborn again and again indefinitely. And seriously, if you come across any other excellent Born Again tunes, tweet at me, at John J. Thompson, and I might add them to the mix. That's it for now. Until next time, this is John J. Thompson encouraging you to turn it up and sing along.
Josh Larson here with Eric Danielson, joining me to talk about Sufjan Stevens' latest album, The Ascension. Before we get to that, Eric, I just want to hear, what's your relationship with Stevens' music generally? Because he's long explored explicitly Christian ideas and themes in his sort of ethereal, dreamy style. I'd love to hear, have you found that to be, you know, curious? Have you found it to be helpful? Maybe it's been challenging in some ways. How would you describe it?
Yeah, so before I get into kind of how I find his music, I unfortunately feel like I'm about to commit a little bit of heresy here in that I find Sufjan Stevens just fine.
Okay.
I'm aware that, I mean, there's a large contingent of my peers, especially on social media, that, you know, revere him to a degree that I just don't. I love some of his albums. I love Age of Odds. I love a lot of the stuff on Illinois. You know, his Christmas stuff is a staple around our house. Will be pretty soon as the year comes to a close. But, you know, I find his highs really high and the rest of his work, you know, just totally fine. And so I come at this, maybe that's a good thing, I don't know, from a little bit of a curious perspective. But the stuff that I do enjoy of his, I was thinking about this before we came on, like I really do appreciate the insight in it, because I'm somebody who probably about, at least as far as my background goes, as insider evangelical as they come. I mean, my dad was a pastor for 30 years. I went to Christian college. You know, I've been a part of this world for a long time. And there are times when I listen to Sufjan Stevens' records and lyrically, when he's discussing faith and the church and just Christians in general, I just hear him and I think, how do you know? Like, you know what this is like. You have the X-ray vision. You see what the church is about. You see what Christians are doing and what they've done. And he seems like the kind of guy that, you know, just has this unbelievable perception of what people are like, and especially what religious people are like. And so, you know, while I'm sometimes mixed on some of the music, I definitely would say challenged and often kind of set back on my heels in a good way a little bit, because I continue to be kind of amazed that there are other people who know some of those things that I feel like I've seen firsthand.
Yeah, that's a great way to describe it, because he has the knowledge, but he also seems removed from it in a way that puts a different lens on it, puts a completely different lens on some of those familiar things. And I think that's what I find fascinating, is endlessly interested in how people kind of explore and examine and express their faith in ways that are at once familiar, but maybe different from my own background, which is, you know, somewhat similar to yours. And he's been a fascinating figure on that front. I think that's why his music, which the airy sound to it, it just sounds wondering to me, you know, like a guy who's exploring. And here's someone who has the language and the tools, but also is just kind of starting out trying to understand the mysteries of faith too. And I can really resonate with that. As far as, you know, where I'd rank him in terms of music, I'm probably with you there too. You know, there are definitely people who love him more, love his stuff more, and have followed it more closely. I think partly because the music can drift in and out of the room a little bit. I've never had an album stick with me, you know, where I'd go back to it again and again and again, even the ones that I've liked more than others. But I will say that has been the case for me with The Ascension. And we could talk about maybe why. Maybe it's more where I'm at than necessarily where the music is. But I have listened to this countless times since it came out, really eager to talk about it. And just generally, I want to get your impression of this album of The Ascension.
Yeah. And one other thing, and this maybe bridges those two conversations, but one thing I do appreciate about him as well is, you know, I think that we, or at least people my age, that I, you know, I was at Christian college in the early 2000s, you know, there was always the joke about, you know, does Christian music, do the worship songs we're singing, you know, are they about Jesus or are they about your girlfriend? You know, that this line. And I think what Stevens does that I think a lot of people my age, your age, you know, just this generation kind of around where we are, had really heard before in art was the actual towing that line between religious ecstasy and desire. I think he does that in a way that we probably haven't seen in our generation, and really does go back to kind of some of the early mystics. And that's kind of why I like the music on The Ascension and some of his other records, because it sounds to me like what church music would sound like if you just like started history in the 2000s. You know what I mean? Like if, okay. if you just started making church music when synthesizers were a thing and started making, you know, music for high liturgy when we had, you know, kind of these decades of reference of folk music and alternative music, I think it would sound like this. And so I do really like the music on this record. I tend to enjoy his more electronic stuff, Age of Odds, you know, records like that, than I do the kind of more orchestral or folk stuff. And so this record is right up my alley in that case, because I think the flourishes and all of the kind of things that he does with background vocals and just some of the really cool touches on this record really hit that kind of mystical vibe for me. I think that's the Stevens I like the most.
Yeah, I'd agree. And then it also has, you know, something like Video Game, which is very electronica, but synth and, you know, as catchy as anything he's ever done. It almost sounds like something that could come from the Stranger Things soundtrack, that 80s vibe. So this album covers a lot in terms of music, but it's also digging into something that's really speaking to the moment, I think. And that's what Joel Mayward wrote about on the TC website. He described Stevens as taking the quote unquote God of America to task. I don't care if everybody else is into it. I don't care if it's a popular refrain. I don't wanna be a puppet in a theater. I don't wanna play your video game. You don't wanna be the one who has to pay for it. You don't wanna be the one who has to change. All you want is what the resume tells you. I don't wanna play your video game. I don't wanna play. So Stevens is an artist who at one point, you know, he had this ambitious project to make albums for each of the 50 states. He only ended up doing one for Michigan, one for Illinois, but that was kind of, you know, his take on the country, this sort of appreciative eagerness to explore and to put those explorations down as music. But now, you know, he's kind of, you get the sense he's become disillusioned with the American experiment, especially on this album, especially on the song America from the album. We played that when it first came out this summer. We played it on an earlier podcast episode. And I got to say, I, as much as some of the Christian religious references will resonate with me across his music, this really resonated with me right now. I mean, I feel like I totally understand what he's going through. I certainly feel like my faith and country have been hijacked by political forces that are dressing up in church clothes, but are really anti-Christian, really anti-democratic. And so the ascension hit me hard that way. That's describing it sort of as a work of protest art. So I'm curious how it resonated with you, Eric, if you do consider it as some sort of, you mentioned folk music, you know, so much of folk music has a tradition of being protest music too. Did you see this as something as a protest album as well?
Yeah, definitely. Everything that you're saying resonates with me. And I certainly, you know, I mentioned kind of my evangelical, you know, bona fides a few minutes ago. I have really struggled over the last, as so many people have over the last half decade or so, with what some of these terms that we've just kind of taken for granted mean when it comes to cultural markers of Christianity and the ways in America that we've kind of identified and expressed ourselves. And, you know, I really do feel like there's a prophetic protest-driven nature to this record, whether it's, you know, on a song like Video Game that you mentioned earlier, just critiquing and saying that there's no there when it comes to our celebrity culture. You know, the emperor has no clothes in that sense. Or a song like America, where he's basically asking God to spare him and has said, don't do to me what you did to America. I mean, I read that line as like, you have poured out your judgment. We are reaping, you know, what we have sown here. And I don't want to be swept under like the country has. And, you know, one of the things that struck me kind of re-listening to it this week is I think some of the great artists and even the biblical prophets of our time, they criticize what they care about, you know, and I think Stevens is deeply disillusioned with America, but I think there's still an affection there. And I hear, it's a weird comparison maybe, but I hear in some of those lyrics, even like a throwback to someone like a James Baldwin, who clearly wanted America to be its best, but was very plain in his way of saying like, we're nowhere close. And I feel like Stevens is getting at a lot of that same sort of attitude in this record.
I actually think that's a really pertinent connection to make. I mean, even Baldwin, someone who famously left the country, right, felt he had to move to survive, yet still directed his critiques back towards the potential of the country that he was from. And I think that's where the ascension can also be seen as a work of hope, too. And this is maybe where I want to circle to this idea of being born again that we're talking about on this episode and how this might fit with the Ascension. I do think he makes a turn near the end of the album with the title song, with the Ascension, because he sings about relinquishing his own desire for power, about refocusing on the powerlessness that is at the heart of the gospel, right? Which is the cross. And there are a couple of lyrics from that song, The Ascension, I wanted to share here. And now it frightens me, the thought against my chest, to think I was asking for a reason, explaining why everything's a total mess. And now it frightens me, the dreams that I possess, to think I was acting like a believer when I was just angry and depressed. Maybe we should just let Stevens sing that, actually. We'll listen to a bit of it. I'll be honest, Eric, that I spent a lot of the last 4 years angry and depressed. Those words totally apply as a Christian, as an American. And I think that what I have to remember now, where we're at right now, is that in some ways that was a lack of faith, okay? That doesn't mean to say that I shouldn't have done what I could to counter the injustice and the hate that was directed towards the vulnerable in those years. That was still good to do, but sort of in my anger, I maybe wavered in my trust in God's sovereignty over all of that. That's what this song makes me think about. And, you know, now there's been a welcome change in power with the presidential election, but this in itself is not maybe something that means the United States is being born again. I think I kind of like had that hope and that instinct, like, oh, I can breathe again. Maybe this is the country, taking this sort of grandiose view of it, being born again. But really, I got to remind myself, being born again is personal, right? It's this continual returning to the cross. It's remembering that the relinquishing of the power that was done on the cross eternally changed the landscape. And that has nothing to do with the temporary political reality. So I guess now I need to not become complacent is one thing, just because this mental weight has been somewhat lifted, but instead just continue to be born again each day, pursue God's justice, maybe this time with a greater trust than I had before. I'm rambling a lot, so maybe I'll just ask you this. I'd be curious to hear if The Ascension sounds different to you at all post-election. You know, it's kind of an album that came to us right when there was this crest. Now we still have it in the wake of that when things are, you know, certainly not completely solved, but feel differently. Does the album resonate with you any differently in this time?
That's a great question. I don't know. If I thought about this a little bit longer, I might have a slightly different answer, but I don't know that I would say that it resonates differently. What I might say is simply that even these days after the election and after everything has happened has just reinforced what I think is important about this record. Again, everything that you're saying about what you've been through, I feel that for myself. And something I actually said from the front of our church recently was that, you know, so many of us have been devastated by the ways that we've seen people who influenced our faith seem to sacrifice some of their integrity or most of their integrity over the last few years. And I talked about how the beauty of the gospel is that even when those people let us down and even when those people seem to tarnish or stain the reputation of Jesus, he's still greater and he's still better than they are. And so, you know, I think that that's one of the things that I love so much about this record. One of the things I appreciate is Stephen's kind of ability to say, I'm not really here for this sort of expression of faith, but I am here for Jesus. And I do want to continue that relationship with the born again, you know, aspect that we've talked about. And so for me, I'm kind of left in these days feeling a little bit better, feeling like I can breathe a little bit more, feeling like there are some things that are not going well in our country that maybe there will at least be blueprints for, that maybe we haven't had blueprints for the last 4 or 5 years. But I'm also reminded how much deep healing needs to occur and how far we still are from doing the work that needs to be done. And I think feeling a little relieved, but also continuing to feel that gap, the idea that Jesus is bigger than the church and bigger than America, which is something that maybe has gotten lost in a lot of circles, that idea comforts me greatly.
Yeah, I think comfort is the right word. It's like feels like a different sort of comfort now than it was then. Maybe then for me, this album came out and it felt a little bit like a lifeline, you know, and now it feels more like a launching pad that's given me a better perspective for which to kind of move forward and move ahead. So I'll probably keep it on repeat and be listening to this more and more than I have any other Sufjan Stevens album. Well, we've written about his work many times on the TC website, including Joel Mayward's piece on the Ascension that I mentioned. You can find those at thinkchristian.net. I was actually surprised, Eric, when I was looking through all those to see that you haven't written about him for us yet. Maybe that speaks to sort of, you know, that you're not a super fan, but maybe it'll be something you can tackle the next time he puts something out. We'll see about that.
I will be deeply fascinated to see. I think he's a little bit more frequent these days, but you know, every 3-4 years has a new record out or a new major record out. And I will be incredibly fascinated to see what the next iteration is. So I'll try to keep my eyes and ears open. Maybe I'll have some strong reactions to that.
All right. Thanks, Eric. Appreciate you joining me for this one.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Like the breeze float straight out of our lids. Them, they got boo by these hard rock Brooklyn kids. Us floor rush when they DJ booming classics. You dig the crew on the fattest hip hop record. He touched the kinks and sinks into the sounds. She frequents deep fatter joints called undergrounds. Our funk zooms like you hit the Mary Jane. They flock to booms, man, Boogie had to change. Who freaks the clips with mad amount percussion? Where kinky hair goes to unthought of dimensions? Why is it so fly? Cause hip hop kept some drama. When butterfly rocked the light blue suede boomers. What about a cut? We push it off the corner.
Diggable Planets there with Rebirth of Slick, Cool Like That. Attesting to the transformative power of music, specifically hip hop. Diggable Planets, one of my entrees into the genre back in the early 90s. Rebirth, being born again, that's a potent biblical metaphor. It's one I find more helpful thinking of as a continual journey rather than a hand stamp into the club. In my Schitt's Creek article, I reference a Today devotional from earlier this year. The Today is a partner program of Think Christian. And in that devotional, A.J. Goretz wrote this: Rebirth in Christ is not a one-time event. Discipleship involves a continuous dying and rising with Christ. As we grow in faith, Jesus cleanses us from sin and reshapes us in his own image. Again and again, we must allow him to reshape our priorities, change our attitudes, and empower us for service. That's A.J. Goretz in the Today devotional. Let's continue that process of reshaping rebirth over the next 4 years and beyond. Thanks to J.R. Forasteros for talking Schitt's Creek with me, and Eric Danielson for sitting with Sufjan Stevens' The Ascension. More music from that album, as well as Diggable Planets and Jack White, can be heard on John J. Thompson's Born Again Spotify playlist. Just search for the Think Christian playlist on Spotify, and you'll find it. How have you been enjoying those playlists, by the way? We'd love to get your feedback on how you've been listening to them or anything else about the show. You can email us at tcpodcast@thinkchristian.net. We could also use some fresh reviews on Apple Podcasts of the show. If you could give us a star rating and a few words, it would really go a long way. That helps us get on people's radar on Apple Podcasts. The Think Christian Podcast is a production of Reframe Media, a family of programs designed to help you see your whole life reframed by God's gospel story. Visit reframemedia.com for more info. Our audio engineer and post-production supervisor is John Reeder, and Reframe's co-director overseeing content strategy is Robin Basselin. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back again in a couple of weeks to consider how another aspect of our pop culture fandom connects with our faith.